Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the August 18th and August 25th, 2017 issue of The Week magazine. And we will start with the cover again. It is a picture this week of the Statue of Liberty, and there is a dark, stormy background. The statue is actually wearing one of these now infamous red baseball caps of the Trump folks that say, "Make America Great Again." And her hand, instead of holding up the torch, has a thumbs down signal. And the caption for the picture says, "Enough already. Should the U.S. cut legal immigration in half?" And with that, we'll go inside and start with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's war of words with North Korea. What happened? President Trump exchanged apocalyptic threats with North Korea this week after U.S. intelligence analysts concluded that Kim Jong-un's regime has created a miniaturized nuclear warhead that can fit inside a missile, a major step toward becoming a full-fledged nuclear power. Tensions began to escalate after the United Nations Security Council unanimously passed a new round of sanctions against North Korea over its nuclear program, leading Pyongyang to warn that it might take physical action against the U.S. and its allies. Trump struck back by vowing to unleash fire and fury like the world has never seen if Kim made any more threats to the U.S. Soon after, North Korea said it was examining plans to strike areas around Guam, a U.S. Pacific territory that hosts a key military base. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said that no one should be panicked by Trump's remarks and that the U.S. was not moving closer to taking military action. Americans, he said, should sleep well at night. U.S. officials believe that North Korea now has an arsenal of about 60 nuclear weapons. And the Washington Post reported this week that U.S. analysts suspect the regime has also produced a compact warhead, a development most experts thought was years away. Pyongyang recently tested two intercontinental ballistic missiles that some experts say could reach as far as Chicago. But the dictatorship has yet to design a re-entry vehicle able to carry a warhead through the upper atmosphere without burning up. Analysts say the technology will likely be complete late next year. What the editorial said: Trump's threat was reckless and unnecessary, said the Washington Post. To raise the specter of nuclear war merely to ward off threats is to draw a red line in the most foolish and destabilizing manner. Americans might dismiss Trump's threat of fire and fury as hype, but a paranoid, belligerent leader like Kim might hear those words very differently. The upshot could be the kind of accidental entry into conflict that has haunted the globe since the dawn of the atomic age. After 30 years of failed diplomacy, the U.S. has no options that don't involve the risk of war, said WeeklyStandard.com. Our best option is to shoot down one of Kim's test missiles mid-flight with one of our advanced anti-missile systems. North Korea would be forced to spend more on its missile program to keep up with our technology, possibly bankrupting the regime. Of course, such an interception might be interpreted as an act of war, but better a confrontation over a test missile today than a full-on war over a real one tomorrow. What the columnist said: Donald Trump with the nuclear codes was always a nightmare scenario, said Gabriel Schoenfeld in the New York Daily News. He's erratic and impulsive and has wondered aloud why we made nukes if we'll never use them. Now Trump desperately needs a distraction. His approval ratings are plummeting, and as the Russian investigation closes in, he faces humiliation of a kind he has spent his entire life trying to dodge. A conflict with North Korea might be just what he needs to boost his ego and shore up support at home. Give Trump some credit. His North Korea strategy has been surprisingly successful, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post. His public hectoring of China and its failure to rein in its client in Pyongyang likely helped persuade Beijing to vote in favor of tough sanctions at the Security Council. Trump's fiery rhetoric could still alienate Beijing, and North Korea might refuse to back down. But there are some signs that his bullying approach might work. But here's the thing. Kim knows Trump is bluffing, said Eli Lake in Bloomberg.com. The last three presidents also threatened North Korea with military action, but never followed through. The reason? Seoul. Pyongyang has enough artillery in range of South Korea's capital to kill hundreds of thousands of people, possibly starting a world war and throwing the global economy into a tailspin. Trump might be impetuous, but he and his advisors understand this reality. So we should expect more gleeful taunts from Kim in the coming weeks, proving Trump's threat was as hollow as past presidents' pledges. As I noted at the opening of the program, we are in another of our two-week issues, so I'm going to take the more time-sensitive news this week, and we'll go a little deeper with features in the second reading next week. And so we'll take a second main story this week. Russia investigation goes into high gear. What happened? Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein this week rejected accusations that the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election had become a fishing expedition after it was reported that Special Counsel Robert Mueller is looking into President Trump's financial history and has impaneled a grand jury. With the grand jury, Mueller's team of 16 prosecutors can subpoena witnesses to provide documents and other evidence and to testify under oath if there is sufficient evidence of a crime. The prosecutors can then seek an indictment. Rosenstein, who appointed Mueller after Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Russia probe in March, said the former FBI director was authorized to look into any matter relating to whether the Trump campaign colluded with the Russians. He said Mueller would need his permission to look at anything outside the appropriate scope of the investigation. Mueller's team is now reportedly reviewing financial records concerning the president, his business, his family members, and his campaign associates, with a focus on transactions involving Russians. Sources told CNN that investigators are hoping to find evidence of financial crimes, which could be used as leverage to encourage subjects of the investigation to cooperate. In a sign of the growing intensity of the probe, it was revealed this week that FBI agents raided the house of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort last month, reportedly to search for tax documents and foreign banking records. Trump, who has suggested he would consider dismissing Mueller if he looked into his finances, told supporters at a rally in Huntington, West Virginia, that the accusations of Russian collusion were a fake story designed to cheat you out of the leadership that you want. In the Senate, two Democrats and two Republicans jointly proposed bills that would prevent the president from unilaterally firing Mueller and require him to get approval from a three-judge panel. What the editorial said. Don't read too much into the revelation that Mueller has impaneled a grand jury, said the Miami Herald. It doesn't necessarily mean that there will be a criminal indictment, much less impeachment. But it does show that Mueller is serious about his task, and that he thinks there may be grounds for indictments. Trump can protest until he's hoarse, but the more he mouths off, the more it looks like he's got something to hide. What do Trump's real estate deals have to do with Russian collusion? Asked the New York Post. Alas, this is the problem with all special counsels. The probe inevitably becomes a quest to bring criminal charges against someone, anyone, regardless of their relevance to the original investigation. Trump would do well to keep quiet, given this is something he can't change without inviting worse trouble. But you can understand why he's so maddened by the whole thing. What the columnist said. Mueller's mandate is actually pretty broad, said Christian Farias in NYMag.com. He was tasked with investigating possible Russian collusion, as well as any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation. With the grand jury, prosecutors can now explore several theories of criminality. Did Trump or his associates, including Manafort and former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, engage in illegal or unreported financial transactions with the Russians? Did Trump's eldest son and his son-in-law continue secret conversations with Russians after meeting with a Russian lawyer promising dirt on Hillary Clinton? And did Trump's repeated attempts to squelch the investigation and his firing of FBI Director James Comey constitute an obstruction of justice? The impaneling of the grand jury is an important milestone, said Ryan Lizza in TheNewYorker.com. It confirms that the special counsel has evidence that crimes were committed, and it will make it even more politically explosive for the president to try to dismiss Mueller. The grand jury news confirms what began as a counterintelligence probe is now a criminal investigation, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. In light of this, Mueller has a duty to inform the public whether Trump himself is under investigation. The ability of the commander-in-chief to carry out his awesome responsibilities is critical to our governance and security, and he shouldn't be under a cloud unless there is a good reason for it. Trump's reaction to all this had an ominous edge, said Greg Sargent in TheWashingtonPost.com. By insisting Mueller's investigation was designed to cheat you out of the leadership you want, the president seemed to be preparing his base for the worst. If this investigation does find any evidence of collusion, obstruction, or any other wrongdoing, he may well tell his supporters it's an effort to steal the election from him and from them. That complaint will ring hollow if Mueller finds proof Trump colluded with the Russians, said Matt Lewis in TheDailyBeast.com. But the broadening of the investigation sure looks like mission creep. And if this turns into a prosecution of the president for, say, tax evasion or some other unrelated financial crime, at least a third of Americans will see this as an attempt to nullify the election results. And they'll be largely justified. Our controversy of the week relates back to our cover picture. It says, legal immigration, time for a new approach. So much for the tired, poor, huddled masses, said the Washington Post in an editorial. We already knew what Donald Trump thinks of illegal immigrants, but now we know his administration holds the legal variety in almost as much disdain. Last week, Trump endorsed the Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment Act, RAISE, R-A-I-S-E, a Republican bill that would roughly halve the number of immigrants the U.S. accepts each year and change the criteria by which green cards are awarded. The bill would end so-called chain migration, which lets immigrants bring over their adult children and extended families and replace it with a merit-based point system that rates candidates by academic credentials, English proficiency, and earning potential. Trump wants to make getting into the United States almost as difficult as getting into an elite college, says Ruben Navarrete, Jr. in USA Today. Our nation has been largely built by desperate immigrants who arrived with little but their hopes for a better life, which is why the Statue of Liberty expressly invites the wretched refuse who are yearning to breathe free. To shut the door on such people is profoundly un-American. Actually, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com, the quote, "Huddled Masses" poem was not added to the statue until 1903, 17 years after it was erected. And why should we craft 21st century policy according with late 19th century poetry? With 1 million immigrants accepted annually since 2000, up from 500,000 throughout the 90s and 300,000 in 1970, it's clearly time to tap the brakes on immigration, to give those already here time to assimilate. As for merit-based admission, this is hardly a novel or shocking idea. Both Australia and liberal Canada favor high-skilled immigrants to boost their economies. Reducing the flow of low-skilled immigrants, meanwhile, will lower the unemployment rate and relieve downward wage pressure on low-skilled American workers. Our government's primary obligation is to protect its own citizens, said Philip Wegman in WashingtonExaminer.com, not to admit 1 million immigrants a year who take jobs from Americans. The economy simply doesn't work that way, said Jeremy Robbins in WashingtonPost.com. Only a small percentage of the American workforce, high school dropouts, competes with low-skilled immigrants for work. For the nation as a whole, immigration is an economic boon, with high-skilled immigrants starting businesses and low-skilled immigrants providing the cheap labor that many businesses need to thrive. Cutting legal immigration would actually result in fewer jobs for Americans. That's why Canada and Australia admit far more immigrants overall, 2.4 and 3.5 times as many, respectively, as a proportion of their populations, despite giving some priority to those with high skills. For the most highly educated immigrants, including scientists and engineers, our family-friendly policies are central to America's appeal, said Mark Regitz and Harriet DeLeap in the New York Daily News. Would Albert Einstein have chosen to live here if he couldn't bring over his sister Maja? There's a middle way forward, says Ross Duthat in NYTimes.com. By embracing the new bill's point system without making its steep cuts in overall numbers, we could ease the pressure of mass immigration on the working class without harming the overall economy. Sadly, this debate has become too polarized for compromise. To the nativists of Trump's base, immigration is an absolute evil. Liberals, meanwhile, are increasingly adamant that any restrictions on immigration are ipso facto racist. So the RAISE Act will likely stall in Congress and will continue debating immigration into the next presidency. And it was a good week for home repairs as the White House underwent a major renovation while President Trump embarked on a 17-day working vacation at his golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey. Golf Magazine recently reported that Trump told 8 members of his club that the White House is a real dump. It was a good week for ambition after a 9-year-old from New Jersey wrote NASA in response to its job listing for a $187,000 per year planetary protection officer. Jack Davis cited his love of space movies and video games and added that my sister thinks I'm an alien. And it was a good week for barroom diplomacy after the Scottish brewery BrewDog announced plans to open a bar that will straddle the border between the U.S. and Mexico, serving brews from both countries. Beer is a universal language, said brewery founder James Watt. But it was a bad week for believing folklore after an Irish lawmaker blamed persistent damage to a stretch of local roadway on angry fairies. There are numerous fairy forts in that area, said Member of Parliament Danny Healy-Ray, who was not joking. Anyone that tampered with them over the years paid a high price and had bad luck. It was a bad week for rebranding after a New York-based apparel company began selling swastika emblazoned T-shirts as symbols of love and peace. The company says the Nazis stigmatized the ancient symbol, but critics say this idea is highly naive and grossly offensive. And it was a bad week for passwords after Bill Burr, who wrote the Bible of Password Creation, said he regrets suggesting the use of random numbers, letters, and symbols. It just drives people bananas, Burr said. And while we're here, a boring but important piece says Trump TV goes live. Political commentator Kayleigh McKinney left her role at CNN this week to help launch Trump TV, a real news product dedicated to celebrating President Trump's success at the White House. In her first newscast paid for by Trump's reelection campaign and posted on Facebook, McKinney touted the strong economic growth of the past few months. President Trump has clearly steered the economy back in the right direction, says McKinney. The former U.S. ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, said the 90-second video felt eerily like so many state-owned channels I've watched in other countries. But Trump supporters said it was standard public relations. McKinney has also been named the new national spokesperson for the Republican National Committee. And we'll take a look at our U.S. at a glance and the world at a glance features this week. Start with the U.S. at a glance. Portland, Oregon. Blistering summer. Temperatures soared past 100 degrees in parts of the Pacific Northwest last week after a high-pressure system known as a heat dome produced a scorching heat wave across the region. In Portland, where the mercury hit 105 degrees, breaking a 65-year-old record, the excessive heat sparked service problems across the metro area's public transit system. In Seattle, where 70% of residents don't have air conditioning, temperatures reached 94 degrees, a daily record in a city that usually experiences highs in the mid-70s this time of year. The soaring temperatures put 15 million people under excessive heat advisories, and animals were sent inside at zoos. We're not used to the heat, said one manager of an ice cream truck that had to shut down for worker safety. We can handle rain, but we are not so great with this amount of sun. Chicago. Sanctuary City lawsuit. Chicago escalated its feud with the Trump administration this week, suing the Justice Department to prevent it from withholding funds from the so-called sanctuary cities. Under new rules outlined by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, cities that refuse to give federal officials information about undocumented detainees will lose certain federal grants. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel said that the city uses those grants to buy SWAT equipment, police vehicles, and stun guns, and likened the Justice Department's action to blackmail, adding, "Chicago will not let our residents have their fundamental rights isolated and violated." In a blistering response, Sessions attacked the political leadership of Chicago and the city's culture of lawlessness. Three other sanctuary cities, Seattle, San Francisco, and Santa Clara, California, have filed lawsuits to block the Justice Department from withholding funds. Bloomington, Minnesota. Mosque attack. A bomb was thrown through the window of a suburban Minneapolis mosque last week as worshipers were preparing for prayers in what Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton called an act of terrorism. Witnesses at the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center in Bloomington said they saw a device being thrown from a van or truck in the early hours of the morning. None of the worshipers was injured, but the imam's office was damaged. A preliminary FBI investigation concluded the blast was caused by a homemade explosive device. As calls grew for President Trump to denounce the attack, one of his national security advisors, Sebastian Gorka, told MSNBC that Trump was withholding comment because the bombing could have been a false flag operation perpetrated by the left. So far this year, 63 mosques have been targeted in publicly reported incidents. During the same time period in 2016, there were 46 incidents. Washington, D.C. Pence 2020. Vice President Mike Pence this week vehemently denied claims he is running a shadow campaign for the presidency after the New York Times reported that Pence is preparing to run in the 2020 election should President Donald Trump not be on the ballot. The former Indiana governor recently embarked on a packed schedule of political events and has already launched a political fundraising operation, the Great America Committee. Pence also installed campaign operative Nick Ayers as his new chief of staff in June. Pence said the article was disgraceful and offensive, and that it was laughable and absurd that he was working on anything other than Trump's agenda. The potential 2020 Republican field is already looking crowded, with Senators Tom Cotton of Arkansas and Ben Sasse of Nebraska making recent trips to Iowa, and Governor John Kasich refusing to rule out a third presidential race. And now we'll go to the world at a glance. A number of short pieces, and we'll start in Montreal. Haitians try their luck. Thousands of Haitians are fleeing the U.S. and heading to Canada to seek asylum. Some 58,000 victims of Haiti's devastating 2010 earthquake have been living in the U.S. for the past 7 years under temporary protected status, which lets them remain in America until conditions improve back home. But the Trump administration has hinted that this status could be revoked next January. Haitians who don't qualify for asylum would then be deported. In June, false rumors began to spread on social media that Canada would give all Haitians asylum, and asylum requests there tripled within a month. So many Haitians have crossed the border that Montreal has turned its Olympic Stadium into a shelter to house 1,050 people. The pace is stretching our resources, said Quebec Immigration Minister Kathleen Weil. Mexico City. Migrants stay put. Unable to get into the U.S. because of stricter border controls, people fleeing drug gang violence in Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala are increasingly opting to try to stay in Mexico. The U.S. Border Patrol says it apprehended 140,024 migrants in the first 6 months of 2017. About half the number recorded in the first half of 2016. Mexican officials predict that applications for asylum in Mexico this year will reach 20,000, more than twice last year's number. The influx now includes Venezuelans who are fleeing their country's economic collapse. So far this year, more than 1,400 Venezuelans have applied for Mexican asylum, up from zero in 2015. Rio de Janeiro. Highway robbery. Road banditry has become a menace to Brazilian truckers. Armed hijacking of cargo trucks has soared in the past few years. There were about 3,500 attacks in Rio de Janeiro state in 2013 and more than 9,800 in 2016. The freight industry expects to lose $1.3 billion to cargo pirates this year. More policing would help, but Brazil's prolonged economic crisis has forced local governments to slash public services, and police are no longer paid for overtime. You have a perfect storm of highly organized criminal networks, high-value goods like alcohol and medicine, very poor infrastructure and government control, and high levels of corruption, Jim Yarbrough, a U.S.-based supply chain security analyst, told Bloomberg.com. Moscow, Putin's manly break. President Vladimir Putin spent his summer vacation in southern Siberia, diving, fishing, hiking, and swimming. And the Kremlin released a load of photos and videos to prove his manliness. Many of the images show Putin, 64, shirtless, exposing a trim physique. Russian television juxtaposed the photos with unflattering images of U.S. politicians, including President Trump and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, looking out of shape while on their own vacations. Analysts said the blitz of photos was a sign Putin will run for re-election next year. We have a new Indiana Jones, charismatic, fearless, hearty, and attractive in every respect, said Elena Yegorova in Mokovsky Kosmonolets. How could you not vote for a torso like that? From Bucharest, Romania, heat wave. Record heat is scorching much of Europe, wilting crops and causing wildfires. Temperatures in Romania hit nearly 108 degrees, and at least two people there died from heat exhaustion. Two teenage Romanian boys also drowned while cooling off in a river. In southern Italy, Spain, and France, temperatures topped 100 degrees, and residents nicknamed the heat wave Lucifer. In Siberia, train services were delayed because some tracks buckled in the heat, and Serbs were advised to avoid alcohol and physical exertion. In some parts of the continent, the scorching heat was followed by violent summer storms, which killed at least four people in northern Italy, including a woman who was swept to her death by a mudslide and a man who was struck by lightning. This from Mirzwalang, Afghanistan. Shiites massacred. More than 50 Shiite villagers, including women and children, were killed in northern Afghanistan this week in what appeared to be the first joint attack by Taliban and ISIS militants. Seven police were also killed as they tried to fight off the attackers. Most of the victims were shot, but a few were beheaded, local officials said. ISIS and the Taliban both follow a radical strain of Sunni Islam, but until now, they have fought against each other, vying for control of territory. If they join forces against Afghanistan's Shiite Muslim minority, Afghan officials fear a new sectarian civil war could break out. Last week, two suicide bombers killed more than 33 worshippers at a packed Shiite mosque in the western city of Herat. Cape Clinton, Australia. Marines declared dead. Three U.S. Marines were killed last week when their MV-22 Osprey heliplane tried to land on a ship off Australia's coast, but crashed into the vessel's deck and slid into the water. 23 people on board the Osprey were rescued. Three Marines were not found and were declared dead. They will live on forever in our thoughts and in our hearts, said Commanding Officer Colonel Ty R. Wallace. The troops had been taking part in a joint U.S.-Australian training exercise involving more than 30,000 troops and 200 aircraft. Since Ospreys went into service in 2007, the hybrid craft have been involved in five other crashes, killing nine more people. Navy pilot Jack McCain, son of Senator John McCain, has called the Osprey, which can cost up to $100 million, a piece of junk. Moving into the columns now, we'll split them between this week and next week, and we'll start with one from the U.S. The Real Bias in College Admissions. Affirmative action for black and Hispanic people isn't keeping white Americans from going to college, said Christina Emba. Rich people are. A leaked Justice Department memo indicates that the Trump administration was considering suing colleges that use race-based discrimination in admissions. The department said it was focusing only on discrimination against Asians, but the news rekindled the long-standing debate over whether affirmative action policies unfairly block qualified white applicants from getting into college. The reality is that the playing field is heavily skewed not by race, but by wealth. At 38 top colleges, more students come from the top 1% of income earners than from the bottom 60%. And who gets the biggest advantage? The children of alumni, who at universities like Harvard, Yale, and Princeton have tripled the acceptance rate of ordinary folk. President Trump himself got into the University of Pennsylvania because of family connections, and three of Trump's children later attended that Ivy League school. Does Trump's base resent that? Evidently not. What gets his supporters riled up is the message, minorities are pushing you out of college. From the United Kingdom, a Brexiteer's version of history. Director Christopher Nolan's World War II blockbuster Dunkirk is a whitewash, said Sonny Singh. The film shows the mass evacuation of more than 300,000 Allied troops from the French coast, where they were surrounded by Nazi forces and would have been lost had not a flotilla of Royal Navy, merchant, and civilian ships crossed the English Channel to ferry them home. As portrayed by Nolan, those troops were entirely white. In reality, Royal Indian Army Service Corps troops were crucial components of the British presence, while the French forces included soldiers from Morocco, Algeria, and other colonies. Even the rescuers from England were a diverse bunch, including African merchant sailors. Dunkirk shows none of that, which is surely why pro-Brexit, anti-immigrant politician Nigel Farage has enthusiastically endorsed it. The film is a thinly veiled Brexiteer fantasy in which plucky Britons heroically retreat from the dangerous shores of Europe. Ignoring the reality that Britain at the time was a global empire, it pushes the alternative history that the UK was a wee island standing alone against the European peril. As Brexit approaches, we must ask whether our refusal to acknowledge the patriotic contributions of brown and black soldiers heralds a wish to excise the same people from a utopian national future. Here's an international column. Venezuela, a growing threat of civil war. Venezuela is now a dictatorship, said O Globo from Brazil in an editorial. Repression and authoritarianism are evident in every aspect of civilian life. Eager to cripple the opposition-controlled national legislature, leftist President Nicolas Maduro has created a new body that will rewrite the nation's constitution and govern with almost unlimited authority until its work is done. The first act of the new Constituent Assembly, whose 545 members were elected in a rigged vote last week, was to fire Attorney General Luisa Ortega Diaz, one of the few critical voices remaining in government. Numerous opposition leaders have been jailed on trumped-up charges. Peaceful protests against the corrupt regime, which has overseen the almost total collapse of Venezuela's economy, have been violently repressed. More than 100 people have died since April in clashes between demonstrators and security forces. Still, there is resistance. A small group of rebellious soldiers raided an army base this week and stole 100 assault rifles and a handful of grenade launchers. A first sign that Venezuelan president cannot count on the full support of the armed forces. The risk of civil war is real, said El Tiempo, Colombia. So far, the opposition has refused to embrace violence, recognizing how disastrous it would be to succumb to the temptation to take up arms. But if the military itself splits, bloodshed will be inevitable. Maduro may copy Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who used a failed coup attempt as an excuse to purge the military of all opponents. As long as the military gets its oil and drug money, it will stay loyal to Maduro, said Joaquin Villalobos in El País from Spain. Any other regime would have imploded by now after 4 months of mass protests that have seen millions of hungry, angry people take to the streets. But the right-wing military and the left-wing government remain allies because they jointly control Venezuela's oil industry and profitable drug trafficking business. Venezuela is now a military dictatorship in leftist clothing that threatens to spread criminality to the whole region. It has already sent tens of thousands of economic refugees fleeing to Colombia and Brazil. If civil war breaks out, even more will follow. Mercosur, the South American trade bloc, has suspended Venezuela, and that's a good first step. But only a boycott of Venezuelan oil can stop this regime. Venezuela would be a workers' paradise were it not for the bourgeois opposition, said Jose Vicente Rangel. Funded by foreigners and representing only moneyed interests, the opposition has arrogant contempt for our socialist system. And so they denounce Maduro's government as illegitimate. Their ethical, political, and moral degradation has fallen to unimaginable levels, and they now encourage terrorism and violence in the street. Our unwavering belief in peace, justice, and the rejection of impunity will guide us through these difficult times. Maduro will prevail. Now we have the from the business page, the issue of the week. Contentious Google memo hits a nerve. It started as an anti-diversity memo on Google's internal mailing list, said Ellen McGirt in Fortune.com. Written by one of the search giant's software engineers, the 10-page manifesto dismissed Google's diversity initiatives as a waste of time and accused the company of being an ideological echo chamber. The fact that women are less likely to be hired for engineering and leadership positions, the author wrote, could be because men and women tend to have different abilities. Women have a stronger interest in people rather than things, the memo read, which could explain why fewer of them are coders. I'm not saying that diversity is bad, the author continued, but deciding whether to hire or promote people based on their gender or race is unfair, divisive, and bad for business. The document went viral inside Google and was soon leaked to the media, setting off a firestorm of outrage, said Aha Romano in Vox.com. Within days, the author was outed as James Damore and fired. And Google, which has long been criticized for having an engineering workforce that is 80% male and majority white, was left to grapple with its persistent diversity problem. Google has a diversity problem, all right. It apparently requires that all of its employees think exactly alike, said Elaine O in Bloomberg.com. Google executives' reaction to the memo was swift and brutal, with numerous higher-ups issuing pointed denunciations. The backlash on social media was even worse. Yet if people would bother to read past the outraged headlines, or better yet, sought out the memo itself, they'd see it has a well-intentioned goal. DeMoor expressly says he is not opposed to closing the gender gap at Google. What he is against are the current policies the company uses to get there, like mentoring and targeted hiring practices that he alleges end up being discriminatory. Is it really so controversial to say that men and women are different? Ask Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Or that, given those differences, it's foolhardy to expect 50-50 gender parity in professional life? DeMoor wrote that Google's left-leaning culture silences anyone with different ideas. The witless and inflamed reaction to his document underlines his point. What's shocking is how much traction this sexist manifesto got inside one of the world's top companies, said April Glazer in Slate.com. On internal message boards, some Googlers called DeMoor brave. At a firm where peer reviews are essential to advancement, it's incredible that DeMoor felt comfortable sharing his plainly bigoted views. It's more incredible that he was fired for saying people should be judged by their skills, not their gender, said David Harsanyi in TheFederalist.com. The fact that you believe he shouldn't be allowed to air such views proves his larger point. Google has become a place where people can no longer honestly discuss conservative ideas for fear of being branded bigots. The same is true of too many closed-minded institutions, including most of the news media and many universities. The idea that men and women excel at different things is well within the boundaries of legitimate debate. Or it used to be. And we'll move over to the obituaries. The Australian sprinter who won it all, Betty Cuthbert, 1938 to 2017. Betty Cuthbert was crushingly nervous ahead of the 1956 Melbourne Olympics. A shy 18-year-old who'd never been so far from her Sydney home, the Australian sprinter wilted whenever an interviewer asked her a question. All I could say, she recalled, was yes and no. But those nerves melted away as soon as she was on the track. Cuthbert won the 100 meters, 200 meters, and 4x100 meter relay and was anointed the nation's golden girl by the Australian press. Being young and shy never held me back. It spurred me on, Cuthbert said. Adrenaline runs through your body. Born and raised in suburban Sydney, Cuthbert worked in her father's plant nursery as a teenager while training in her spare time, said the New York Times. Convinced she wouldn't make it onto Australia's team for the 1956 game, she purchased tickets as a spectator when the Olympics neared. But Cuthbert was the standout star of Melbourne, becoming the first Australian to win three Olympic golds. Cuthbert failed to defend the titles at the 1960 Games in Rome, owing to injury, said The Guardian. She took a two-year break from sprinting and considered quitting the sport. But Cuthbert changed her mind in 1962 after hearing what she thought was the voice of God urging her to run again. The voice came back again and again, she said. Finally, I said, okay, you win. I'll run again. As soon as I said that, this wonderful feeling came right through my body, and I was mentally keen to want to do something again. Cuthbert took gold in the 400 meters at the 1964 Tokyo Olympics, becoming the first athlete in the world to win four different Olympic events. Cuthbert was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1969, after which she dedicated much of her life toward raising awareness about the condition, said the Sydney Morning Herald. I know people listen to me, she said, because they know what I used to do before, run. Cuthbert returned to the Olympic stage one final time in 2000 when she carried the torch during the opening ceremony of the Sydney Games. To hear the roar of the crowd when I came out, she said, I still get goosebumps when I think about it now. And we are on the talking points page. Afghanistan, should the U.S. pull out? President Trump faces a stalemate in Afghanistan, said Jim Michaels in USA Today, not only on the battlefield, but also inside the White House over how to end America's longest war. As the conflict approaches its 16th anniversary, an increasingly frustrated Trump is torn between two camps. The first, led by senior advisor Stephen Bannon and other America First nationalists, favors complete withdrawal or replacing U.S. forces with private security contractors. But Defense Secretary James Mattis and National Security Advisor Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster want to bolster the 8,500 American service members already in Afghanistan with another 4,000 troops and stay in the country indefinitely. Trump blew up on his military brass last week, reportedly likening their advice to the poor management of his favorite restaurant, Manhattan's 21 Club during the 1980s. He also threatened to fire General John Nicholson as commander in Afghanistan. We aren't winning, Trump complained. Trump clearly doesn't know anything about Afghanistan, says Max Boot in CommentaryMagazine.com. Warfare isn't similar to running restaurants, and Nicholson is losing ground to the Taliban only because of the paucity of resources available to him. A modest surge to push U.S. troops above 10,000 would help us train Afghanistan soldiers and prevent the country from falling once again under the control of violent jihadists. That includes Al-Qaeda and ISIS, as well as the Taliban, which has retaken a third of Afghanistan. If, however, Trump indulges his isolationist instincts, says the Wall Street Journal in an editorial, he'll own the consequences of the country's collapse. The pictures of Taliban marching into Kandahar and Kabul and tearing down the schools for women that the U.S. has done so much to support wouldn't be pretty. Still, it's time to reevaluate this costly, unwinnable war, said Daniel DePetris in WashingtonExaminer.com. We achieved our main objective when we demolished Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda infrastructure. As soon as the mission switched from killing terrorists to building a brand new Afghan political system, we became bogged down in a hopeless task that has cost $700 billion more than 2,400 American fatalities. Rather than prop up Afghan government indefinitely, said Philip Carter in Slate.com, the U.S. might be wise to scale down to a narrow counterterrorism objective. Trump likes to delegate military decisions to my generals, but this policy decision is on him. Leaked calls, what they reveal about Trump. For Donald Trump, all politics is personal, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. Leaked transcripts of President Trump's January phone calls with Mexico's President Enrique Peña Nieto and Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull reveal a president who sees complex world affairs solely in terms of his personal political brand. In the conversations published by the Washington Post last week, Trump tells Peña Nieto to stop telling the press Mexico won't pay for his promised border wall because it makes Trump look bad. I cannot live with that, Trump grouses. In the combative Turnbull call, immigration hardliner Trump angrily complains about having to honor President Obama's stupid agreement to accept 1,250 Muslim nation refugees from Australia, even if they're heavily vetted. It will make me look terrible, Trump says. Despite Trump's tantrums, neither Peña Nieto nor Turnbull give an inch, said Michelle Goldberg in Slate.com. So much for the idea that the putative author of The Art of the Deal is any good at deal making. These conversations should not have been leaked, said Elliot Kaufman in NationalReview.com. Presidents need some assurance of confidentiality in their discussions with foreign leaders so they can speak openly, honestly, and bluntly. Now Turnbull, Peña Nieto, and every other foreign leader will think twice about opening up. Yes, it's titillating to see what Trump's hypocrisy over the border wall, his obsession with press coverage, and his strange world choices. But a few laughs aren't worth damaging the U.S. government. Whoever released these transcripts single-handedly introduced a new kind of instability into the international order, said John Potthertz in CommentaryMagazine.com. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has vowed to prosecute the leakers, and in this case, I hope he or she is exposed and shamed. Though leaking presidential phone calls is potentially harmful, in this case, it is justified, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. Trump is revealed as frighteningly obsessed with himself and his image and clueless about the concerns of other world leaders. Trump's narcissism also leaves him open to flattery by adversaries like Russia's Vladimir Putin, suggesting he'd be more than willing to make the country's interests subordinate to his own need for personal affirmations. Our president simply cannot fulfill the role of commander-in-chief, and that's a far greater national security risk than some leaked calls. And we'll finish out with a thought-provoking quote from historian Daniel Boorstin, quoted in The Atlantic. I'm still trying to figure it out. He says, "We risk being the first people in history to have been able to make their illusions so vivid, so persuasive, so realistic that they can live in them." And I will leave you with that thought. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast on our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5100.